G'day, I'm Megan Woodward, and this is Crop to Top, the Cotton Info podcast. Conversations to help you grow.
In this episode, we've a guest host behind the microphone. He's usually being asked the questions, but today our Cotton Info technical lead for IPM, Paul Grundy, is asking the questions. Enjoy this discussion between Paul and his QDAF colleague, research scientist Richard Sequeira, recorded on location in central Queensland.
Welcome, Richard.
Thank you, Paul.
Richard, just wondering if you can give our listeners a little bit of insight as to what things were like here for the industry in the late 90s when you started your career, and what were the real pest management challenges that growers were grappling with on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I arrived in Emerald in 1996, straight from Vancouver, where I was a university researcher for a few years. And the first thing that I encountered was this big problem that the industry was grappling with, which is boll worms, Helicoverpa, Armigera, and Punctigera. And a number of things struck me at the time. Firstly, there was a lot of energy and resources and time being committed to solving the Healy problem in cotton, because it was such a big problem. There was one crop or the other being sprayed with something almost every day, and you could smell it in the air, no matter which part of town you lived in. I couldn't help but wonder at the time, what did I get myself into? Because back in Canada, I was working on Canadian summer cropping systems, quite different to what we experience out here. This is one crop which is a big revenue earner for the national economy. And the critical mass of people that were actually working on this one big problem, it was an eye-opener, but it was also exciting because there weren't just a lot of people involved in working on this one problem. There were also ideas being generated, and there was free flow and exchange of ideas, even competition for ideas. And all that made it a really exciting industry to work in. But you couldn't help but realize that it wasn't ecologically sustainable. I can remember crops being sprayed 15 to 20 times in a season. Yeah. So essentially once a week or more frequently sometimes. It was scary, but it also was a challenge to say, what can I do? At the same time, there were technological developments, well, that promised to make a big difference.
Well, I guess that brings us to about the time that you commenced. InGuard had been released. It's the first generation of BT cotton. It was a single gene product, not the version of BollGuard 3 that we grow today. But if I understand, Emerald wasn't sharing in the benefit of that technology as it was released. Can you fill our listeners in as to why Emerald didn't have access to that technology, whereas the rest of the industry did at that point in time?
Well, there was a lot of excitement in the Central Highlands about there being a way forward to managing the Helicoverpa problem in cotton. However, by 1998 or so, it became apparent that the transgenic cotton drive was focused around the southern, the bigger cotton growing areas. And Emerald was considered the hot spot where all the problems began. We were notorious as being the first major cotton producing center where pyrethroid and OP resistance was first recorded and became a huge problem. So there were fears that if the technology were to come unstuck, this would be the place where it would happen first.
Yeah, and then no doubt spread to elsewhere in the industry.
So there was a push from the developers of the technology to minimize the risk. One tactic was to leave central Queensland cotton areas outside the zone where the technology would be utilized in the first instance, until such time that somebody was able to demonstrate that there were potential approaches to managing insecticide resistance development and minimizing it for the central Queensland region that would work hand in hand with the broader resistance management strategy for the technology in the southern areas. Obviously, that caused a lot of angst among the local growers because given all the hope and the hype that this technology had generated up to that point in time, suddenly the carpet was basically pulled out from under their feet. Now, that pushed us to try and find a way forward to demonstrate that we did have some ideas on how resistance development could be minimized in warmer growing areas such as central Queensland. We would have to be creative in how we approach that. So with that in mind, we did pursue some of the ideas for managing resistance differently to how it would be done in the southern areas. And that's where the whole concept of winter trap crop areas and summer trap cropping, etc., came into being.
In effect, I gather that gave license for growers in this part of the world to have access to that technology.
Yes, we were able to demonstrate with some success to the Australian regulatory authorities that we did have a potential tactic that could be deployed. It wouldn't necessarily change gene frequencies in the population, but it would minimize the size of the resistant population in relation to the susceptibles, which would then give refuges a better chance of working the way they would in the southern areas. Because cotton is a long season crop, there are several generations of moths developing within a cotton season in a cotton crop. So that gave us some hope that we would be able to minimize the size of that last generation, which is the one that has the potential to migrate out into other cropping areas or other crops and take the resistance alleles with them. If we could find a way to minimize that, then that would give us some breathing space and help solve the problem. Essentially, we needed to demonstrate to the regulatory authorities that we had a mechanism whereby we could contain the risk of insecticide resistance and minimize it to the level where it would be more or less comparable to what was happening in the southern areas. The southern cotton strategy was heavily reliant on pupae busting, which had its own limitations. So what we were able to successfully demonstrate was what was being proposed for warmer growing areas such as central Queensland and even further north would in effect be more or less equivalent to what could be achieved in southern areas.
Yeah, and I guess no sooner had the dust settled on that piece of work that you did, which essentially gave the growers in central Queensland access to InGuard technology, a new pest in the form of silverleaf whitefly materialised very rapidly on the horizon. Would you be able to sort of explain a bit about how that came about and just the challenge that that posed at the time?
It was always in the back of my mind that given the nature of the transgenic cotton technology, it would undoubtedly be successful in minimizing the big problem that had faced cotton for many years, which is Helicoverpa. But if you take a very big chunk out of the insect spectrum, the question then becomes what will replace it? Because the moment you take one key aspect of the problem out of the picture, something else replaces it. Yeah. So what's that going to be?
Nature's very good at using up space.
Exactly. We had an entomologist by the name of Bernie Franzman in the department back then, doing surveys for many years across large parts of the cotton belt, looking for, in particular, silverleaf whitefly, because he was convinced that it was only a matter of time before silverleaf whitefly appeared in Australia, because it had been making its way through almost every country where cotton was grown, Africa, Asia, China, South America, etc. It was only a matter of time before it turned up in Australia. And he was convinced that it was already here, even as early as the mid-90s. He was finding very, very low levels of silverleaf whitefly nymphs on wheats. I remember back as far as 1996, when I first came to Emerald, he had found silverleaf whitefly, but in very, very low numbers, and it wasn't considered a problem. So it just traveled under the radar for a few years. 2001 was a very hot, dry year. And at the end of the cotton season, leading up to 2001, for the last 2 or 3 years before that, the late planted crops, especially in one part of the Emerald irrigation area, were being infested with fairly significant populations of whitefly. But very, very late and only on 1 or 2 crops. And nobody paid much attention.
Easy to ignore.
So that was the launch pad for that insect. And conditions were right in 2001 for it to just explode. And it did. It was a different kind of a shock to the cotton industry than the Helicoverpa problem. Because Helis had been around for at least 2.5 decades prior to that. So people knew what to expect and what the problems were. But this was an unknown entity. And given what had happened in other jurisdictions around the world, Arizona in particular, where it had devastated their industry. There was the expectation that something similar could happen here. It was more of an existential threat to cotton than Healy's had ever been. And I say that because having Healy's in the system, you could still produce cotton. Yes, it comes at a cost of a huge number of sprays. But whitefly could contaminate lint and essentially make your lint unmarketable. Once that happened once or twice, the industry is branded for the foreseeable future as being low quality, sticky cotton, which nobody wants. And that stigma was what made it an existential problem for the industry. So the fear was that we could lose the industry if we didn't get on top of this problem.
Yeah, perceptions certainly are rock solid at times.
And we didn't have any information that would have led us to come to any different conclusion, because we just assumed that what happened in Arizona would automatically happen here if we couldn't get on top of the problem.
Obviously, whitefly is not a problem today in central Queensland. So in a nutshell, what made the experience after that outbreak different here compared to Arizona that had this problem for a number of years?
There was a couple of issues that I think were the points of differentiation between Arizona and central Queensland. For one, Arizona was hot and dry, so there was a much greater likelihood that lint that was contaminated with silverleaf whitefly honeydew would become sticky. There weren't any ameliorating factors, such as the higher humidity that we have in central Queensland, the different microbial fauna and flora, if you want to call them that, which assist in the breakdown of honeydew under humid conditions, most of which did not really exist in Arizona. So anytime the Arizonan cotton growers got sticky lint from silverleaf whitefly, there was an almost certainty that they would have a problem.
Yeah, if it got sticky, it stayed sticky. Yeah.
But the research team working on the whitefly problem in central Queensland was able to demonstrate quite convincingly that, yes, we could handle more silverleaf whitefly honeydew on lint than Arizona could without necessarily having a sticky problem. But that was not a real solution. It was a bit of insurance that, okay, if everything else failed and you couldn't get the crop off, if you left it in the field long enough and you got a bit of rain on it, that a lot of the problem sugars could be broken down. The other issue was that we had a very different community of beneficial insects in Australia and central Queensland in particular that the Arizonans didn't have a lot of. Particularly parasitic wasps, which are very efficient in controlling populations of whitefly. We had a lot of them here, and they just needed a few seasons to adapt to this new food source for the system to come into balance. Now, it so happened that this problem landed in my lap, and I really thank my stars that I was trained in an environment in North America where the focus was always on applying basic ecological principles to problems of invasive insects, you know, metapopulation dynamics. And that training really helped me and my team, because we started out by asking very simple questions like, where is it coming from and where is it going to? If you can understand that, then you understand the interaction between the animal and its new environment and the cropping system and how all those bits fit together. And once we understood the big picture of what was happening from one season to the next, i.e. the interseasonal population dynamics, and that pattern, and what were the trigger points, and what were the weak links in the temporal population dynamics, then we could try and develop strategies to fit into that, curative options. And the Arizonians, to their credit, did have a number of good insecticidal products and approaches to managing the community, pest and beneficials together, which could be brought to bear on this problem.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we did. We used very traditional textbook ecologic approaches to understand the population dynamics, spatial and temporally. And then that led to development of very simple dynamic threshold type solutions to understanding when to treat populations And we had a couple of good new generation products that could actually manage insect pest populations without crashing the system like the older type chemistries were prone to doing. And I think that was the cumulative outcome of all these ecological principles married with soft, environmentally sensitive approaches to controlling insects, which gave us a solution.
So whitefly did spread throughout the rest of the industry, and over a period of a decade or more, we saw outbreaks in different parts of the industry as it progressed south. And you've been involved in nuancing threshold work and looking at how this pest is interacting with the environment. Can you sort of speak to why silverleaf whitefly seems to be so balanced in central Queensland but still causes us problems in some of our central regions, for example?
When you have a highly invasive species moving into a new area, it just disrupts the system completely because it doesn't have any of its usual controlling or balancing factors around, or they haven't developed to the point where they can effectively control the new pest. So for the first 1, 2, maybe even 3 seasons, the new pest will explode. And then in time, once the local regulatory factors gain momentum in their own population dynamics, that's when the system eventually comes into balance. Unless there are ongoing crop management type activities which continually disrupt the system. But if those management interventions or activities are done in a way which favors maintaining the status quo, then the system comes to some sort of equilibrium and roughly stays there. There were a few peaks and troughs from time to time, but generally in balance. So that's what happened in central Queensland. By the mid-2000s or so, 4 or 5 years after the first outbreak in 2001, silverleaf whitefly population dynamics in central Queensland were fairly stable. Unless somebody went chasing mirrors or something like that with hard chemistry, there wouldn't be much of a silverleaf whitefly problem. Yeah. But one thing about central Queensland is because the climate is warmer and different from the southern Queensland and New South Wales, our beneficial communities in CQ are active a lot earlier than they would be in southern parts. And that does have a bearing on how the pest beneficial dynamic manifests itself all the season. Yeah. It is, of course, different because in the south, there wasn't a full season problem with silverleaf whitefly. Even as late as 2010, there was whitefly recorded in a lot of southern Queensland and central northern New South Wales cotton growing areas. It was a marginal problem, but by then I think the research community had learned from the lessons in 2001. So there were a lot of researchers in the south, particularly Lewis Wilson, ex-CSIRO, who was well aware that silverleaf whitefly had moved south, was building up, and would in due course become a problem. But given that CQ had so much experience in managing this problem, he said, look, would you be happy to help us move forward? We can work together. So it became a collaborative effort with CSIRO and DAF jointly working to try and understand what would happen once the silverleaf whitefly built up in the cooler regions of the cotton growing belt in Australia to a point where it became a recurring problem. We spent a lot of years trying to understand the ecology in the southern areas.
So as whitefly settled down and found a balance, Emerald lived up to its reputation once again with things often occurring here first when it comes to pests.
I think it was in 2009 or 2010, we got this new invader, Solanopsis mealybug, which still is quite a challenging problem to deal with. Mealybugs are typically a manifestation of a disrupted system. Up to that time, southern growers had not really experienced a lot of silverleaf whitefly. So they had a lot more perceived freedom in how they could manage their key pests of cotton in those areas, which is mirids and aphids and sort of other occasional mites. But it still hadn't dawned on many of them that the freedom that they had in managing those pests, how and when they chose to, would be short-lived. Because with silverleaf whitefly being a relatively late-season pest in those areas, and Solanopsis mealybug now appearing on the scene and had the potential to manifest itself all through the cotton season from squaring to wall setting. And if it wasn't handled properly, the flow-on consequences for managing whitefly would be that much worse. So it turned out to be an IPM enforcer of sorts and really triggered the need for focused attention from southern cotton growers and crop managers.
Yeah.
on the best way to manage the whole system. Yeah. So it was unfortunate that they got these pests, but it did help to trigger some real hard analyses and going forward, thinking about the problem and how we could deal with two or three different key species and the interactions among them and how we could manage controlling all these pests without flaring one or the other.
Yeah.
And causing bigger problems.
You've seen the worst of Helicoverpa until BT technology and our understanding of resistance mechanisms and ecology, we've come up with what has been a sustainable deployment of BT crops in Australia, which sort of stands apart from a lot of the rest of the world. You've seen silverleaf whitefly, Solanopsis mealybug. Thinking forward, without wanting you to make a prediction, what are your thoughts around the potential challenges the industry might face in the coming decade?
I think going forward, the key to ensuring the viability of crop protection in cotton is really maintaining the efficacy of transgenic cotton, whichever generation that is. Now we're into the Bolgard generation.
Yeah, Bolgard 3. And Bolgard it's 3, to the point, it's worked so well for so long that you can't help but feel we take that technology for granted in some respects.
And the only reason we are able to manage silverleaf whitefly successfully the way we are now is because the Bolgard 3 technology is keeping bollworms at bay.
So essentially, I guess what you're saying is not only has Bolgard largely solved our challenges with Helicoverpa, but it more or less underpins the management of our other key pests. And without Bolgard, we would struggle to manage the other pests. Yeah.
It is a really well-known, well-established, and well-documented fact that spraying with disruptive chemistry that is used to manage sucking bugs of different types can flare whitefly very easily because the little hymenopteran wasps that keep whitefly populations in check are very delicate, and they are highly susceptible to disruption, especially in periods when the population is just building. Around the late squaring, early flowering, that's when these beneficial insect populations, the wasp populations, are just getting established. And any shocks to that system which knocks them out in that early stage could then result in a much bigger whitefly problem later in the crop. It will also knock out a lot of the beneficials that control mealybugs. And so it's essential that Bolgard 3 and its successors keep bollworms at bay, because that's the pillar that sustains management of these other pests.
I think that's a really good concluding message. We often think about Bolgard being sustainable Helicoverpa management, but it ultimately is sustainable pest management of all of their pests. And
all period.
When we make those investments in the RMP, growing a good refuge, adhering to crop destruction timelines, planting timelines and the likes, it's not just for Helicoverpa management, it's for the management of each of those main pests that we deal with every season.
It's very easy to overlook the value of things like managing refuges, making sure they're attractive and they're functioning well, pupae busting and all the other. Farm hygiene has a massive impact on pest population dynamics. But it's easy to overlook that because it's often a chore that you have to do and it costs a bit of money, and the immediate benefit of doing that is often lost. But these are very fundamental chores or activities that keep the whole pest complex problem manageable.
Thank you very much for your time today, Richard. Really enjoyed this discussion, and I hope our listeners can take away quite a few messages from that, particularly just the importance of some of those things around the RMP that really underpin all of our pest management. I think it's a real key takeaway message. So thank you.
Cheers.